We may say, and we believe, that God made us, made you as an individual, made you unique. He made you wonderfully, right? We believe that because the Word says it. But then how much time do we spend looking at other people and saying, oh, they're so much better looking than I am. Why couldn't I look like that? Why couldn't I have that appearance? Another example is you may have bought a house. And when you bought the house, you thank the Lord for His provision for you. You love the house. And you even had a time where you may have even dedicated it to the Lord. And then you sign up for a small group at Apostles. And you go to this new group and you go into the host's home and you look around and go, wow, this house is nicer than ours. This house is bigger. And you, instead of concentrating on the Bible study, you're sort of looking around at the decorations that are nicer than ours, right? Or it could be that, you know, I know some people who are single. And in their mind, they're thinking, my life will really begin once I'm married. But I also know people who are married, and they spend their time complaining about their spouse, oftentimes thinking and looking back at, wow, remember those days when I was single and I had so much freedom? There was a time in my life, or when I was a teenager, that I wanted to be three things. I wanted God to make me, or at least change me, to be good-looking. I wanted to be athletic, and I wanted to be musically talented. I wanted to be able to sing or play the guitar or something like that. And God said, no, I think I'm going to make you average at all three of those. And some of you are thinking, TJ, average might be a little bit of a stretch for you, but that's okay. But instead, God did, you know, God did. He said, I'm going to take those three things. Instead of giving them to you, I'm going to give all three of those to Paul Reeves. And that's why I hate Paul Reeves. But, you know, we live in an epidemic of comparison, because we spend great time and emotional energy focusing on the way we wish our life was. And yet, we claim that we fully believe in God's sovereignty and His goodness to us. Do you see the contradictions there that I see? So in core this semester, the theme, what we've been talking about is, what does it mean to be a disciple? What does a disciple of Jesus look like? So, not long after Jesus' death and resurrection, and then He gave the Great Commission, and then people were coming to faith, and probably the best known convert who became a disciple and then became an apostle is this guy named Saul of Tarsus, right? Who later became known as Paul and wrote a lot of the New Testament. Paul had it all. He had been a scholar. He was a high-rising Pharisee. Though he was born in Tarsus, they moved to Jerusalem, so he was schooled under probably the most sought-after rabbi you could get, a guy named Gamaliel. He also had Roman citizenship, which meant that he probably came from a family of some degree of wealth. So Paul had this prestigious, comfortable life until Jesus came and messed everything up for him. Take a look, if you will, in 2 Corinthians. Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 11, and 2 Corinthians 11 contains what is basically Paul's journal of how things went for him after he came to faith, after the Lord won him to Himself, and after he took seriously the call to discipleship and was sent out on mission for the gospel. So this is what we're looking at. So we're going to, in verse 23, Paul writes, Acts writes of, let me back up. Paul writes of the frequent imprisonments, the frequent floggings, and the many near-death experiences that he had. And we're going to pick up in verse 24, 2 Corinthians 11. He says, 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was pelted with stones. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night at sea and a day in the open sea. I have been constantly on the move, been in danger from rivers, danger from bandits, danger from my fellow Jews, danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, in danger from false believers. I have labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I've been cold and naked. Besides everything else, I face the daily pressures of my concerns for all the churches. This was Paul's journey of discipleship. This was the life he experienced as part of God's call for him. Now, where am I going with all of this? So as we talk about what it looks like and what it means to be a disciple of Jesus, what that looks like. So are we going to talk tonight about this area of commitment and sacrifice? Now, while those are two very, very key traits of a disciple of Jesus, instead, we're going to focus on something different. We're going to take a deeper, probably even more personal look at what is basically a heart issue. And that's the heart issue of contentment. Contentment. Contentment, even in the midst of the unknowns, even in the midst of the unclear, the unpredictable, the uncontrollable, and the uncomfortable. Because when the journey of discipleship takes us to places that we wouldn't have otherwise chosen for ourselves, when that happens, God still has a plan. He still wants us to experience his peace. Even in the midst of all that, he still wants us to experience joy. He still wants us to experience security regardless of our circumstances. So now I want us to fast forward a little bit with Paul. So a few years after what he wrote there in 2 Corinthians, we're going to find ourselves in Philippians. So if you just go ahead and turn to Philippians chapter 4. As you're turning there, does anybody know where Paul wrote Philippians from? From where? From prison. Exactly. So in the first chapter of Philippians, he tells us this. He says, and I am in chains, and everybody in the whole palace guard or Praetorian guard, what it says, they know that the reason that I'm here in chains is because of the gospel. There was no doubt about that. So with this backdrop that he gives us, with this context of where he's writing from this cold, probably damp, probably dark, very lonely prison cell, Paul writes these words in Philippians chapter 4, starting with verse 11. He says this, "But I'm not saying this because I'm in need, for I have learned to be content in whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all this through him who strengthens me." It's all good. So, you know, these aren't just nice sayings. You know, you look at that Philippians 4:13, a lot of people have that, you know, tattooed, you know. But I don't know if they understand the context. Paul knew what he was speaking of when he writes these words. But how does he do this? He tells us. He gives us the key. He tells us that he has learned something. He's learned something that is so unique and so surprisingly vital that he calls it a secret. A secret. And what's the secret that he learned? The secret of contentment. What a beautiful word. What a beautiful posture of the heart, a contented heart. And yet, in my observation, it's really rare. Even among people who follow Christ closely and long for that, to experience it is a different thing. But isn't contentment part of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus? The Greek word for contentment literally means that we experience sufficiency, that what we have is enough to meet our needs, whether those needs be material, whether they be physical, maybe they be from our inner person. All that is needed is being provided for us. That is what contentment means. Now, I want you to listen at how Melissa Kruger described contentment. Now, Melissa Kruger is the vice president for discipleship content for the Gospel Coalition. She's also an amazing author and teacher. And most of all, most important, she has been an interview on Candid Conversations with Jonathan Youssef. That's at the top of her resume. But listen to her description of contentment that she wrote. So Melissa Kruger writes this: "Biblical contentment is an inward trust in God's sovereignty and his goodness that produces the fruit of joy, the fruit of peace, and the fruit of thanksgiving in the life of a believer, regardless of outward circumstances. What a great way to capsulize what Paul calls the secret key that drives his perspective in the great times or in the difficult ones. Incidentally, parenthetically, that article that I was quoting from, we've got copies of that for you because it's all about contentment. And you'll probably learn more about that from her article than you will learn from me tonight, but we'll have copies of those on the back tables when you're leaving if you want to grab one. That's just a little commercial announcement. But true contentment, even though it's longed for, it's often very, very elusive, isn't it? I think that if I told you that there is a website you could go to tonight when you get home, and you can go and you could order 6 months of genuine true contentment for your life, some of you would put your credit card in there and probably pay large sums of money in order to get that. It's something that we long for. But how does it work? Because we know it doesn't work that way. I come up with a few questions that I had in looking at this. Why is contentment so elusive? Why do so few people live it out? What is the secret to true contentment? Does it come all at once? How do we know when our heart is truly content? Can we just flip a switch? Or is it something that we learn? Does God give it to us and then we're good and then we're covered? Or is it something that we can only learn through experience? Lots of questions. How do we get answers on this? Well, I think that there's so much that we can learn from one another, others that have journeyed down this road before. And part of the way that we set up, we call it next generation discipleship is this, and of course you've been part of this. It's designed for people that are in their 20s through 40s, but you have table leaders, kind of mentors, short-term mentors, table leaders, who are, shall we say, a little more seasoned. Okay, we're older. But you know what? Some of us have got some stories to offer, some things to share that hopefully could be of some value. As such, I want to invite our friend Mary O'Brien to come up and join me here because I got some questions for Mary.
Okay.
Now, so a lot of you know Mary, and especially those of you, of course, that have been at her core table from day one. And Mary works on our staff, so those on our staff, our staff, of course, know her well. So Mary is our Director of Member Engagement. And I just learned that this is your one-year anniversary of being on staff
here. Church.
Yeah,
yes.
The church.
Mm-hmm.
Having served many years at leading the way as well. And so as Director of Member Engagement, she also really serves and helps her ministries really throughout the church, kind of across the board. And she's really an invaluable teammate, especially working closely with Jonathan, but also with all of us, really helping propel us toward our church's mission. In other words, she does a bunch of really good stuff. And so that's a little bit of the background, the context that where she finds herself now. But I had wanted to, in light of this topic, I had asked Mary before if we could find out a little bit about her journey up to this point. And
yes.
She agreed.
Yes.
So thank you, Mary. Welcome.
Thank you.
So Mary, you told me that you had grown up in a home where your family believed in God. But it wasn't until you were at Clemson in college that this idea of faith and grace and a personal relationship became something that you understood. So that
yes.
was in college.
Mm-hmm.
So fast forward a few years later, you're in your mid-20s, you're here in Atlanta working in the mental health field. So how would you describe that point, that time, your life and as well as your hopes and desires for what might mm-hmm. come next?
Yes, so I was living here right after school. That would be in my early 20s in the 90s, so that dates me as seasoned. Just really growing in my faith, I had a group of great friends here, Christian friends, and just really anticipating the life I'd always imagined, which was, around the corner, getting married, having kids. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, and great volunteer at our school and all those things. And that was just kind of what I pictured about to unfold in my life.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. And so then a couple years later, mm-hmm. I think you said you were around 27-ish or so mm-hmm. at that time, mm-hmm. something very much out of the blue kind of came about, something unnecessarily not expected.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I was just, you know, a healthy young lady living here in Atlanta, and I started just to have some strange off and on symptoms, and, you know, had gone back and forth to the doctor. And ultimately, I was admitted to Piedmont Hospital with an infection in the lining of my heart. And, you know, at first it was just, okay, we're going to treat this. But within a few days, I found out that this infection had done a lot of damage to the mitral valve of my heart, and I was going to have open heart surgery. So again, I just went from what I thought was just a perfectly healthy person to finding this out. So it was shocking, a lot to take in, and I'd been pretty even keel with it. And then a few days before the surgery, I met with the surgeon, and he was kind of describing, hey, this is what I'll be doing, and these are the potential outcomes. One was they could maybe fix my valve that I had. The other was you're going to have to get a mechanical valve. And he's like, you know, at your age, that's not ideal. You'll be on blood thinners the rest of your life. You know, he kind of lists all the things. But I really can't tell you until I'm in there what I'm going to do. And then he just very casually says, and as you know, you won't be able to have children. And I was just kind of like, wait, what? You know, just shocked by this. He thought someone had already told me this information. So at that point, that was really the crisis of the whole thing for me, was just there was this outcome coming that I didn't know what was going to happen. I couldn't make a decision about, and it was obviously going to affect my life for the rest of my life, and certainly my hopes and dreams. So,
what was your faith like at that point in time, and how did that come into play?
Yeah, so, I mean, thankfully, again, I've been walking with the Lord, and really at that point, for several years, I'd been in BSF, Bible Study Fellowship, so really studying the Word, probably for the first time in my life, really studying and learning God's character. And so that was all very helpful as I was kind of processing this. But I realized it was kind of this like, you know, do I truly believe what I was saying I believed? Like, first of all, if I die, do I really believe I'm going to go to heaven? You know, if I live, but I live with circumstances that I don't want, do I trust God with that? Do I still think God's good? So I was kind of wrestling through these things during that time. And, you know, just really, there were some aspects of this. There was like an extreme procedure that I'd heard about that would have maybe avoided this thing happening to me. And so I started reading a lot about that, asking a lot of questions, and kind of trying to control this situation. And a very wise doctor who, again, I wish I had time to even just tell the whole story of how I ended up talking to this man. But he said to me, you know, you need to let go of that and do what's best for you and just let go of this. And so in hearing that, you know, I was kind of able to process that and just really go back to the Word. I spent weeks in the hospital leading up to this surgery, so I had a lot of time to read my Bible. And I really was reading Psalm 139. And, you know, there was a verse in there that just said, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days were ordained for me, were written in your book before one of them came to be. And I remember just really like, this is like the rubber meeting the road. Like, do I believe God's sovereign? Do I believe that he knew from the moment he created me what's about to happen to me? And can I trust him with that? And so I do remember, like, I literally, like, got on my knees by the bed and just, like, you know, I had no control, but I was releasing what I wanted to control and just telling the Lord, you know, I trust you with this. And so, you know, and really saying, if I wake up and hear what I don't want to hear, I know you're still good. And so thankfully I woke up and was extremely relieved when they told me they repaired the valve of my heart. I did not have the replacement. A doctor came to me and said, hey, I watched your surgery. I can't believe he did that. I thought for sure it would be you'd need this mechanical valve. So it felt like a real miracle and just a huge blessing. And to me, it kind of indicated again where my life was heading. Like God had done this miracle and, you know, I wasn't going to have to face this outcome. So,
yeah.
Mary had told me before that she had, I guess a friend of yours had a blog, and she asked you to write, or you wrote a piece for it. Mm-hmm. So I asked her if I could read that. She sent it to me, and so for probably the next 10 years or so after the heart issue,
You'd shared of some milestones, of some that were kind of some growth markers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So over those next 10 years, you know, I mean, my faith continued to grow. I became a leader in Bible study fellowship, which was really such a time of growth for me and getting such strong instruction. And so my faith was growing. I did some counseling that, you know, dealing with family issues from the past and things like that, which really, again, brought me into this place of feeling like I was in a pretty healthy place. But there had been no marriage, there had been no kids. And what I found was, at this stage of life, it is very consuming. It's very mentally consuming, because it's all you see around you, it's what you've expected, it's what you want, and it's weighing on you behind all of the other stuff. Whatever your unmet desire is, it's weighing on you. And I remember in this season telling God, I feel a little tricked by you. Like, you did this amazing thing, but you didn't follow through on it. And that, I'm just being honest, that was how I felt. Like, I couldn't understand the sequence of events. But what I also remember was the Lord really saying to me, you know, again, and not rebuking me like harshly, but in a loving way, like, I did the best thing for you. I gave you great health. Like, you have not had one issue since this happened. He gave me a good gift in it. And that was what he was doing. You know, I was making it about what I wanted it to be about in my life, if that makes sense. So that was just kind of part of that season. And then just really grieving, I think, like, when you know, over that season of life, it was like seeing things kind of pass me by. And there was, like, a true deep grief to that. And even as TJ and I were preparing for this, I was recounting something with him, and it got me really, you know, emotional. And I told him, I'm like, I'm not sad about it today, what I'm telling you, but it makes me remember that pain. And that was so real. So it was, you know, again, it's been a nice journey kind of talking through this and being able to say, like, oh, I'm at peace with that now. But that was really painful in that season. So I say that to also say, I think grieving things is so important. When we don't grieve them, we can't really fully heal from them. So I'm grateful for that time, even though it was very painful. And so the other thing, I guess, like, I do have some of my notes here, the thing that I also would say during that season was battling Satan's lies. Mm. And it's kind of like, whatever the thing is you're dealing with, it's, you know, you start to believe certain things, like, well, I'm never going to not feel this way. You know, something must be wrong with me. God must be doing this to me. Or what have I done? And this is why this is the outcome. And they're all subtle things, but you're buying into some of those, or at least battling them and, you know, silencing them. But the way I like to describe, so coming up on that, like my late 30s, I think I was striving against the Lord is the way I put it. And that was more in, I knew him, I did love him, I did believe him, but I was kind of like, but if what you have for me isn't what I want for me, I don't want what you're doing. You know what I mean? And it was like kind of like a two-year-old, like, felt like I was digging my heels in a little bit against him. Like, I had no control, but I felt like, I'm just letting you know, I'm not happy with what you're doing. So.
And wasn't it around that time that, maybe within the next year or two of that that identification of that struggle, that I think you said something like, God did a big work in you. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So just kind of over those next few years, I just had some, you know, there were some big life events maybe that were happening, and that included, you know, a relationship that ended, but it was through I had a major job change, and as you mentioned, I worked at Leading the Way for many, many years. And at one point, I took a different job and left and on good terms, thinking like, oh, it's just time for me to move on. I mean, within 6 months, I was back there in a different role, like things I could have never mapped out or planned and wasn't planning. And it was during that season, it was like, I just felt God's hand so closely on my life. I saw that he was directing things and that, you know, he was working things out in my life in ways I couldn't. And I told TJ, I'm like, I don't ski, and I would probably injure myself greatly if I did now. But it was like what I imagine is like skiing down a mountain and feeling like you're going to lose your footing, but feeling so secure because God is the one leading you. And that's how I started feeling in that season. And I just kept thinking, like, well, if God's got his hand so clearly on these aspects of my life, why do I not believe that he's got his hand over all areas of my life and just let him do what he's doing? And I have a woman who I call my mentor. She says we're friends, but she's really my mentor. But
more seasoned than you?
She is more seasoned than me. Way more wiser, way more everything. But I remember one time, again, not in a harsh way, but in a really loving way, her saying to me, Mary, God's not withholding a good gift from you. He gave you Christ. He gave you everything. And she's like, and there's nothing else he owes you. There's nothing else, you know, like, he's good. And having someone speak that to you, in real love and encouragement, it stayed with me. And I mean, I shared that with you, mm-hmm. you know, when we were talking, like, it's back in there. I mean, it has stayed with me. Like, it's so true. Like, he's given me everything. There's nothing he's withholding from mm-hmm. me. So that was a key thing. And the last thing that I would just mention in that season was shame. And I recognized no one else was doing this to me, but I was feeling ashamed that my life didn't look like what I thought it should look like or what other people's lives looked like. And I was letting that hold me back, you know, bring me down. And I even put down here, there was just an example of a family that I was close to who had invited me to their daughter's wedding. And it was out of town. And, you know, weddings are kind of one of those things like, well, I don't have anybody to go with and, you know, whatever. But they, like, offered to get my room. They just wanted me there. And I ultimately didn't go. And she told me later, again, in a loving way, like, just that had hurt their, like, it was disappointing to her. And I remember that because that was the season. And I was like, you know, like, why am I living under that? Like, why aren't I living the life God's giving me, enjoying it in confidence, and just, you know, doing things like that instead of like, oh, ho-hum, I don't want to go do that. And I'm not engaging with, you know, people who love me and I love them. And so that was like, I just remember that so clearly being part of that recognizing kind of shame and the selfishness in that. So around that time is when I would just say, I just was saying this to Elise, it's like God lifted something off me that I couldn't lift off myself. And I recognized that he did that, and it just really, it freed me up. And it was what you were quoting Melissa Kruger earlier, like, it was like I was learning contentment. You know, it's a lifelong process, but I really can remember feeling like I'm learning that. And like that, it was so freeing. It was just so freeing. So it was another kind of rubber meets the road time of just accepting that his plans are best and his ways are best, and I'm okay with whatever he has. So, yeah. And I feel like it was a page got turned in my life, and here I am 10 years after that period of time, and I would say that page hasn't turned back. Like, that was a true,
that's really cool.
He turned a page in my life. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one last question. So as you think back over this journey, are there any, what might be some of the maybe key factors or themes that maybe continue to keep you on this life of contentment?
Yeah, I put a few little things down and I'll expound on them, but I would just say being and staying in the Word would be the number one thing. And I think back to my 20s all the way till now, you know, that is what grounds you and grounds you in his truth, even when you're not feeling it, but you're grounded in the truth. Having Christian community, and so like I mentioned my mentor who's so important to me, but being in Bible studies like that, being teachable with people like her who were older and wiser than me, and just kind of leaning in when you don't feel like leaning into the Lord. Like, you know, like it's easier sometimes to lean away when you're not, I guess, happy with where things are, but staying leaned into Him. And I put down here, I remember in this sanctuary years ago, us singing Blessed Assurance one Sunday. And it got to the part where it was like perfect submission, perfect delight. And I remember in my head, like feeling teary and being like, Lord, it's not a delight sometimes, really. Like, you know, and it just, again, being honest, but still doing it. So that leaning in, keeping perspective and having gratitude, I feel like just reorienting when I need to. Kind of, you were giving great examples of all the things we can just become so easily unhappy with or discontent with. So keeping a perspective, I worked with persecuted believers for a long time as part of the ministry, and truly talk about something that helps you reorient really fast when you're hearing what people are struggling with, their circumstances, their life, and their goal in life, though, is to glorify the Lord. So it just reminds you it's not about me, you know, it's not about my circumstances. Again, being grateful, I just mentioned that, but just focusing on not what we don't have, but what we have. And then the last thing, and again, these wise people have taught me this through the years, is focusing on today. And, you know, you think about, like, there's so many Bible verses that remind us He gave them manna from heaven, what they needed that day, not for the next day, but for that day. You know, the Lord tells us, don't worry about tomorrow. I'll provide what you need when you need it. And I just, my same mentor once told me, what ifs, when you're what ifing the past or you're what ifing the future, rob you of the joy of today and what the Lord's doing in your life today. So I feel like not getting ahead of ourselves or looking back too much, but just being in the moment. So just kind of, you know, I know we need to wrap up. I wanted to share, I'm in a Bible study right now here at Apostles. We're doing Jonah. And just last week, like, this is what the author, a little paragraph she'd written, that I was just like, you know, again, the word is living and active, because it was perfect for tonight. And this is when Jonah is in the belly of the fish, crying out in chapter 2 to the Lord. And she had, this is what it's all about. Him being glorified. He is always after our good and His glory. I've noticed many times when trouble comes and I cry out to the Lord, the circumstances rarely change before He uses it to bring a change in me. He will use it to build my faith, change my attitude, still me, strengthen me, and grow me in His image, among other things. It's amazing when we find ourselves relinquishing blank, whatever we're relinquishing, and find ourselves thanking Him for the victory won in the hardship before a single circumstance changes. And sometimes circumstances won't change this side of eternity, yet we live victoriously. And a victory had been won in Jonah's heart while he was still in the belly of the fish. So just grateful for that, the victory He can win in our lives, in our hearts. And I told TJ, I'm like, if you had told me X number of years ago, I'd be willing to sit with you in a group of people and talk about this and talk about it with joy and true contentment, I wouldn't have believed you, because I would have just said, no, I don't want to be that person, you know, or I'm not that person. So I pray that does encourage anybody. Everybody's circumstances are different. Some of you are dealing with really heavy things in life, and other unmet desires or other struggles. And so I just hope it is an encouragement of how we all can grow in learning contentment in the Lord.
Yeah. I don't think there's any doubt. So thank you, Mary, very thank much. You. Yeah. Thank you. Let's thank Mary. They like her over there. Mary, can I share what you had thought about saying as you were ending?
Oh, yes.
So Mary had said, what I want to tell the people is please, please, please don't any of you come up to her and say, I have somebody I'd like to set you up with. She really, really doesn't want that. So very good. So we're going to go to tables in just a second, but I want to wrap up with, you know, full circle with Paul. you know, when Paul was writing in Philippians about this thing of contentment, that was near toward the end of his ministry. But the last thing, the last epistle that Paul wrote to Tim, it was in 2 Timothy. And in 2 Timothy, he knows that his martyrdom is imminent. And he says this, so it's kind of interesting to go, okay, is he still holding on to this contentment, right? And this is what he says. He writes them in chapter 1 of 2 Timothy. He says, yeah, I am suffering. He says, but I'm not ashamed. He says, because I know whom I believed. And because I know whom I believed, what I know about him makes me, he says, I'm confident that I can entrust to him and that he would guard this gift, this treasure until that day. And what I thought was interesting was this. Paul didn't say, I know what I've believed. He says, I know whom I've believed. And I think it's because he knew the trustworthy character of the God that he followed that allowed him to take whatever was most dear to him. Now, it could have been he was talking about, could have been his sufferings. It could have been the ministry. It could have been the churches. It could have been his own thoughts of how he wanted his life to go. It could have been his fears about his death. Whatever was most valuable, he said, I know I can entrust you because you're trustworthy. So that, I think, was the key to Paul's contentment. That kind of backed up his life. And, you know, before I brought Mary up here, I mentioned some questions that I had about contentment. And as Mary was speaking, I thought, she's answering, in a lot of ways, all of these questions that I was bringing up. So thank you very much, Mary, for bringing us in to be it sounds a little corny, but a living epistle of this topic tonight, of what it looks like as a disciple of Jesus to live in contentment.